Shift is brought to you by Henkel. Founded in 1876, Henkel operates globally in three business units, including Adhesive Technologies, Laundry and Home Care, and Beauty Care. Within Adhesive Technologies, Henkel provides chemistry solutions for a range of industries, including automotive manufacturing, with technologies that benefit the entire value chain. Learn more at www.henkel-adhesives.com/emobility.
Hi, everyone. Welcome to Shift, a podcast about mobility. I'm Pete Bigelow, your host and reporter from the Automotive News.
And I'm Alexa St. John, mobility and suppliers reporter for Automotive News.
Today's episode is going to focus on the sensors needed for automated vehicles. As I think a lot of people know, Elon Musk is famously anti-LiDAR, thinks LiDAR is lame, thinks it's unneeded. But at the same time right now, I think there's a growing consensus in the industry that we do need more sophisticated sensors on vehicles, especially to get to kind of level 4 or 5 automation.
Yeah, there's definitely a combination of sensors being used right now. But you made a great point that there's definitely a need for better technologies. So cameras, radar, infrared sensors, they all have advantages. But now there are ground penetrating LiDAR sensors as well.
So joining us on today's episode to talk about sensors in general and ground penetrating radar in particular is Tarek Bolat, Chief Executive Officer of WaveSense, which is a Boston-based startup that is taking a technology that's kind of traditionally been used by utility companies and in archaeology and applying it to the automotive space.
And not all of these technologies are completely foolproof. As we know, cameras have limitations, you know, sensors aren't perfect. Different conditions can impact their usability, things like weather, nighttime driving, lane condition, being inside a parking garage, or just the possibility of misreading an object can all kind of impact the applications that these sensors that currently exist have.
Yeah, I think there's definitely... you need an assortment of sensors for redundancy. And it's interesting to see the auto industry kind of break away from what we've assumed is the defined set of sensors and now look at things like infrared. Just saw supplier Veoneer announce a deal for infrared a couple of weeks ago. And now you have something like ground penetrating radar, which can be used to localize when there's snow obscuring lane markings or other kind of lousy weather out there.
Definitely. And really, you know, all of these are meant, I think, ultimately to really stitch together a view of, you know, an autonomous vehicle's surroundings. And I think will be largely part of, you know, the success of AVs moving forward.
Well, maybe without further ado, let's take a quick break right now. And we will be back with Tarek Bolat, CEO of WaveSense, to talk about the evolution and potential revolution in the sensor field.
Deloitte estimates EV car production will reach 35 million units by 2030. This transformation from traditional engines to electrified powertrains requires material solutions that support large-scale assembly, operational safety, and lifetime performance. Henkel offers chemistry solutions from design to integration, including thermal adhesives and gap fillers that enable heat transfer to the cooling plate, keeping the battery operating within an ideal temperature range between 15 and 35 degrees Celsius. High-speed curing with short cycle times, such as battery assembly adhesives that cure on-demand with UV light within less than 15 seconds. Liquid gasketing that prevents leakages and provides sealing reliability by compression, while enabling the battery pack housing to be reopened for repair. With strong application know-how, R&D test centers around the world, and strategic alliances, Henkel is driving the future of e-mobility. Learn more at www.henkel-adhesives.com/emobility.
Tarek, welcome to the podcast.
Yeah, great to be here. Thanks for having me over.
Oh, great. We're very excited to have you today. Let me get started a little bit. You know, it strikes me that there's like at least 60 companies in the LiDAR space that are competing and innovating and trying to kind of pioneer the LiDAR sensor for the purposes of ADAS and autonomous vehicles. By contrast, we hear very little about people pioneering radar advances. So let's kick this off. Tell me why you're so excited and bullish about radar.
Yeah, that's a great question. And you're right. We do see a ton of competition, which is great in the LiDAR space, and less so for radar. In one sense, because it's a less newfangled technology, and as a result, it's typically been used in more sort of less sexier automotive applications, in part because what we're doing is a totally new approach to using radar and how to use it, and really think about how to solve the problem of localization and positioning in general. It's really a shift in perspective. So I think there's sort of two answers to your question. One is that radar has been a historically a sleepier technology than LiDAR has, especially in autonomous vehicles. And then two, you know, why you don't see another company doing radar the way that we do it is simply because, you know, our CTO invented this technology. And the way the data that we're looking at is just totally different than what you would typically look at if you were trying to replicate how a human is driving in a machine.
All right, so follow up on that. What is WaveSense and what is the unique technology you're working on?
Yep. So WaveSense is a company that was started 2 years ago. We're a startup, and the technology that we are doing, and this is the cornerstone of our product, is positioning or localization, as we call it in the sector, to very, very high degrees of precision. And the way that we do that, which is sort of unorthodox, is rather than looking around the surface or using GPS, which would be the typical ways of doing it, we use a low-frequency radar that goes underneath the vehicle and points to the subsurface or points to the road and maps the subsurface about 10 feet down. So we drive over a lane. We're scanning the road over 100 times per second. That's creating a unique fingerprint. You're getting reflections off of things like changes in soil type or soil density, roots, rocks, cavities, utility infrastructure. We don't really care actually what we're seeing. What we care about is that we have unique and repeatable fingerprints or details. And the reason that's so important is that you want something that's very feature rich. So, you know, sometimes you're driving down a road on a highway, let's say, and there aren't features around you, aren't signs or trees or that sort of thing. And it's really hard to do localization. Whereas you look underneath the ground and there's always something to look at.
Great. And so, I mean, say you're driving, you're going 45 miles an hour, and you're not really getting the exact same, you know, signature twice, or you're not necessarily in the exact same spot in, you know, the most precise way. So how do you kind of match that using your technology?
Yeah, this is actually one of the core innovations of the technology, is that you don't have to be perfectly overlapped to your previous map that you've created in order to do localization. You can be offset. And so there was a lot of sort of proprietary technology that went into actually developing that when this technology was being initially developed. But the upshot of it is that you actually don't need full lane coverage to do localization. I can drive down the center of the lane when I'm making the map, and then let's say that the car is driving down the right side of the lane later, it's able to, as long as it has some overlap, it can still localize.
That's really interesting to think of localizing not with a camera or LiDAR. I mean, like you said, this is subterranean as opposed to above ground, and that's such a stark difference in a way that we don't naturally think about mapping.
Yeah, I think that's right. You know, the reason that we do it is because we're trying to create the most reliable and precise localization out there. Of course, each of the sensors, when it's doing well, can be very precise, but reliability is the key here. By looking at a set of features that is static, so it doesn't change in the same way that, you know, the dynamics of a surface, you know, you can imagine if you're driving in downtown Detroit here, downtown Boston, where we're based, a place like New York City, it's really hard to have a stable map in those situations, let alone when you have inclement weather, you know, snow coming down, rain coming down, etc. But by doing localization without regard to what's going on the surface and looking at that very stable map, we're able to do it in any kind of scenario.
Can you talk a little bit about if this is for both autonomous and driver assist features and what the differences might be between those two?
Yeah, for sure. So, you know, we candidly began with sort of an AV hypothesis. This technology, you know, began its life automating military vehicles. And so that was really where we began things. But, you know, with the hypothesis, whatever the phrase is, the hypothesis survives, you know, first contact with the market and then is discarded. And indeed, that's what we found in that we confirmed it on the AV side, but there's been a sharp pull into, ADAS or level two systems. We found that there's really a bottleneck on high willingness to pay features around reliable positioning. And because WaveSense unlocks that bottleneck, we've seen significant interest for things like autonomous parking, which is sort of a white whale in the ADAS and L2 industry, as we've learned, and things like active lane keeping. And so we're really excited about the AV market, but we think we're going to be building much sooner than that a very big business on the back of the ADAS and L2 traction.
I'm curious a little bit about that shift. Is that because the technology has been kind of like the self-driving technology has been, everybody's working on that for L4. Now it's trickling down to driver assist features. Or is it because there's a realization in the industry that we're a long way from level four and people need to make some money in the short and medium term. So they're kind of investing more and keeping a bigger eye on the driver assist side.
Yeah, I think it's a confluence of a few different trends all coming together at the same time. One is you've had tremendous amount of capital and tremendous amount of engineering resources, talent going into the L4 question. And that hasn't yet been solved comprehensively. But the upshot of it has been that you've had a maturation of these important and very powerful technologies that have made their way, trickle down, to use your phrase, Pete, into the ADAS stack. So I think that's thing one. I think thing two is all of the press and PR and capital that have gone into AVs have sort of made the traditional OEMs and tier ones have to respond in sort of a qualitative way. There's a lot of buzz around it. Wall Street and consumers are wondering what their response is. And as a result, they've spun up and adopted these technologies in a pretty compelling way. I think thing three is consumer driven, which is that more and more consumers are making buying decisions based on technology enabled features. And you see that with things like the Super Cruise coming out and some of the new feature sets that are coming out, especially in the premium segment. And I think that the OEMs are feeling pressure to compete along that access, in addition to sort of traditional branding and traditional metrics that a consumer might evaluate.
So going off that, are you currently working with any OEMs or tier ones, or is there anything there that you can publicly talk about right now?
So we are working with several of the top global OEs and tier ones. Of course, it's all under confidentiality for the moment. We're hoping to make some announcements, as early as Q4 of this year. But the trends are similar, which is that, you see a real impulse to differentiate against peers. And because WaveSense is the only company that does localization as reliably as we do, it's basically viewed as a significant differentiator, whereas the LiDAR game is a little bit harder to play. Back to your point, Pete, is that, how do you make a bet, how do you make a long-term bet where you're spinning up supply chains if you're an OEM, on a LiDAR, on a specific LiDAR, because that competition is still very much in play right now. And I don't think that there's a consensus winner yet.
So one of the knocks against LiDAR is simply its cost. It's expensive, even though it's coming down. Would your technology be more in line with what traditional radar costs on a vehicle now? Or because it's very specialized for a particular use case, is it higher end like LiDAR, somewhere in between? Like, can you give me a general?
Yeah, it's a good question. So we're like automotive radar. So the bill of materials on this is under $100, which is very attractive both to the ADAS and L2 segment. Obviously, it's almost an afterthought, I guess you could say, to the AV segment, in terms of its percentage of relative percentage of cost there. So, we're lucky that we have the tailwind of cost at our back.
You mentioned this can really help enable automated parking earlier. Walk me through exactly what role ground penetrating radar would play in helping to enable that feature.
Yeah, so there are a couple of interesting things going on here. One is that parking, it turns out, is really, really hard to do localization in, because if you're in a lot, you're typically in a wide open area where the only surface features typically are cars, which are moving, so you can't use them. And then if you're in a garage, it's a highly repetitive and therefore undifferentiated environment. Also no GPS, of course. And so that makes it really, really challenging to do. So that's sort of thing one. Thing two is that it's a bottleneck on sort of general uses of autonomy. So you have to start and stop typically in a parking lot. And so you can figure out all this stuff in between. But what happens is that you actually need to park the car or you need to get the car and you're not able to do that. I think thing three is that, as we all know, you know, especially if you live in a city, finding you can spend 80% of a given ride, you know, finding a parking spot. So it's a real pain point for consumers. And I think there's really a willingness to pay as a result.
So I have a question about the parking, since you mentioned the parking garage. Is it hard to get a signature or a return through the concrete that I might see in a parking garage, or are there other limitations to ground penetrating radar in general?
Yeah, so that's a good question. We were actually working with a top five global OEM on parking only, and one of the things that we're really focused on is parking garages, and this is true with our work with tier ones in parking as well. And what we found when we did a parking garage was that it was actually working really, really well. And this is true on the concrete roads around here in Detroit as well. And so you're able to get a unique enough signature because of the way that the energy spreads out and then comes back to the antenna that allows you to localize. And so it's a question we get often. People are sort of thinking, well, if you're going 10 feet down, but there's only, you know, 2 feet of concrete and rebar, you know, is it unique? And indeed it is, and we've shown that time and time again.
Kind of going off the barrier point that Pete mentioned, the other hurdle that we kind of see related to automakers, you know, getting ready for AVs is the idea of, you know, lane stripping that's been, you know, dilapidated or can't be read, or that signs aren't always standardized, or that they change, you know, from country to country. So are all of these other infrastructure hurdles irrelevant with your technology?
So they are irrelevant in a way that you can still do localization, of course, without lane markings, or if you have chewed up lane markings or inconsistent signs. The way that our technology works is you can embed lane markings or your lane position in it when you're creating the map, and then that's how you know you're in your lane going through. And so, you know, one of the real features here is, and we've shown this, we actually have some public videos about this, is in a snowstorm, which is a good example, both because it's cool to see a car go in a snowstorm, but also because it's a good example of when you have like a total blanketing of features, including lane markings. And we've shown, I think, in this particular instance, about sub-3 centimeter lateral localization throughout the entirety of this route.
All right, so three centimeters, excuse me, laterally. What is the accuracy longitudinally? And I assume that's a function of speed in some way, but
it is, yeah. That's so when we're going slowly, we typically see that sub-3 centimeter, sub-5 centimeter type of accuracy. So call it a parking lot setting. When you get up to about 70 miles an hour, you're seeing typically sub-15 centimeter localization accuracy longitudinally. It's consistently sub-5 centimeter in the lateral direction. The reason for the degradation of accuracy, you know, a long track as we call it, is that you're doing a fixed frame rate in effect. And so as you go faster, your frames are spread out further.
Okay. So would that be akin to the sweep rate too? Is that the same?
Yeah, it's
same
the same
term?
Thing. Exactly. Okay.
The way we've created cars right now is we've tried to replicate in sensors what the human eyes have seen. And this is like really the first technology that I can think of where you've kind of detoured from that idea that, you know, sensors don't have to replicate what humans do. You might be able to do something that's very different and better. Is that kind of a, you know, a building block in some fashion of like where you fundamentally start with the technology?
Yeah, I think it's really part of the shift in perspective that we're driving overall, is that you've typically, you know, as you said, Pete, tried to replicate kind of human cognition in AVs. And we're firm believers that, you know, while it's fun to make jokes about how, you know, this city's drivers or that city's drivers, you know, perform, humans are actually pretty darn good at picking up a bunch of the subtleties that go around in the roads. And so in order to get 10x, 100x better than human drivers, which is what we think needs to happen to really drive public adoption here, that you need to be able to leverage data that isn't available to humans. And so subsurface data is an example of that. Whereas you can say, aha, there's actually this data set that we can leverage that can give us an unfair advantage in terms of safety and reliability. And so that's what we're doing.
So are there other data sets that are useful to AVs that are available that aren't necessarily available to humans?
That's a good question. There aren't any that sort of at least come to mind that are so kind of physically clear. I'm sure there's different analysis. One could make the argument that the analysis that you're running in simulation allows you to come to insights or arrive at insights that perhaps a human couldn't do in terms of safety and in terms of how to operate safely. But there isn't sort of another physical data set that I could think of.
Talk to me a little bit more about ground penetrating radar. And I know its history is this was developed at the MIT Lincoln Labs. What exactly is the Lincoln Labs, and what are some of the other non-automotive use cases for ground penetrating radar?
Sure. So MIT Lincoln Laboratory, as you said, is where this technology was born under a large program there that was led by our CTO, a guy named Byron Stanley, who's the world expert in localizing ground penetrating radar. Lincoln itself is a federally funded R&D facility for the U.S. military. Lots of different types of stuff go on there. It's very separate from the academy side of MIT. It's a lab that develops prototypes for the U.S. military. That's run by MIT. And so the things that one might use it for are things like doing tunnel detection. I know is a public one that it's used for. In the civilian side, it's used for like archaeology, for utility, infrastructure finding, on a one-off basis, search and rescue, that sort of thing. And so I think one of the big insights that Byron and the team at Lincoln had was that if you saw what these images looked like, there's sort of an aha moment that you could actually match them to do localization.
And to do localization at scale, it seems like is another
exactly.
Kind of like when you talk about making it practically useful for the auto industry,
yep.
that's the next dimension to add there.
That's right. And so that's been where a lot of our focus has been over the last 18 months or so is how do you, take this, which has a lot of technical advantages and a lot of value to add and scale it up in a way that makes sense from a cost perspective, from a design perspective, from a packaging perspective. And that's a lot of the work that we're doing with the OEMs and tier ones right now.
Going off that, putting this kind of in more competitive terms, there are so many, only so many dollars that automakers are looking to spend when it comes to driver assist features or AVs. So can you talk about the context where this could reduce the need for LiDAR or the number of LiDAR beams that are needed?
Yeah, that's a great question. So one of the things that the OEMs that we've been working with have suggested on the AV side is that they believe they can reduce the number of beams, to your point, that they're using for LiDAR by reducing the field of view. Now, for a layperson, what that basically means is you've got a LiDAR or set of LiDARs that are looking all around the vehicle. And that field of view, as we would call it, is doing two things, perception and localization. For the part of that field of view that's only doing localization, some of the OEMs we're working with, based on the results they've seen in the POCs we've done with them, think that they can eliminate that field of view that's only doing localization because our localization is so robust. And so that's sort of what's taking some cost out of the equation.
I'm curious that when you first proposed meetings, shortly after founding the company, this is such an, out of the box concept for the auto industry that I'm curious if you had to, what hoops you had to jump through to get people to buy into the idea that this could actually work, and what were some of the initial reactions you got from OEs or suppliers?
Yeah, so we've benefited from the fact that it is a pretty cool technology from an engineer's perspective. You're mapping the subsurface, you're tracking to it. We have the way I like to describe it to folks is we've had a steeper hill to climb relative to other technologies in terms of market education, but once we hit the summit, which we've done, the way down is steeper and quicker because we're the only game in town, and so we're not fighting tooth and nail against RFP for LiDAR. Where you have a bunch of companies that are all going all in on that and making crazy assumptions on cost and performance and what have you. We're the only game in town. And so while it took more to educate the market and people, it can be a head scratcher, and sometimes still is a head scratcher for folks, depending on who you catch. We're now in a position to sort of dominate the market for GPR.
Yeah, I want to underscore something Alexa mentioned earlier about the infrastructure, and you know, you don't have to worry necessarily about what the lanes look like and how they're striped or how reflective they are, which is, you know, some of the traditional things that I think people think AVs will need. And at the same token, you don't have to worry about the weather. Like you said, if there's snow blanketing the ground, you don't have to worry about that. How about as far as like keeping the sensor clean? That's another one of those, you know, hurdles for above ground facing sensors to, you know, face. Do you worry about that in the same fashion, or because the radar is actually under the vehicle facing down, is it not really face those same problems?
So it's not really a concern for us, and it's something that the OEMs and Tier 1s have really liked about this technology. So if you have an optical sensor, you have to keep that clean, you know, obviously. And there are a bunch of interesting and innovative solutions being proposed to that. But at the end of the day, it's another hurdle to get over. And because of the frequencies that we're in, unlike your typical automotive radar, which is at a much higher frequency, things like ice buildup or anything like that don't cause us issues. So it's very rugged to the environment, sort of intentionally so.
So if there were any concerns, what would they be, or any limitations?
So I think, you know, the ones that we typically think about, and they're sort of edgy, but I'll mention them anyway, is if you have a long flooded area, basically a flooded road. So for radar, water, especially salted water, can be challenging. So if it's a puddle or even, you know, a long puddle, you kind of blow right through that based on how often you need a good position. If you were to drive, you know, if you're having a 100-year flood, hopefully you're not driving this anyway, but if you have a 100-year flood, you know, the sensor would have some issues. Similarly, you know, some bridges, it's sort of a minority, but some bridges are made of metal tiles, you know, with some asphalt over them. That just looks like a very bright reflection to our sensor. And so you'd want to rely on other sensors in that case. But it's atypical for us to encounter those types of environments.
So typically you want a return from a depth of about 10 feet. Is there anything important or magical about 10 feet? And could you go higher, lower, or get the same result?
So there's nothing magical about it. It's something that we found sort of on average produces good results. But back to the parking garage example or an overpass example or a bridge example, you're able to get unique, repeatable character even in some of those scenarios where you would imagine there's very regular structuring. You're able to get a unique and repeatable character and fingerprint all of the time there. So there's nothing magical about it. It's something we found works well. You know, we may revise it in the future if we think it makes sense to from a power or a performance perspective.
You mentioned that this was developed through Lincoln Labs, which develops products for military purposes. Is this something that's already in the field, you know, essentially at commercial scale and being, you know, being used by the military?
So the only thing that I know about it is what's public, which is that it was put into Afghanistan for operational assessment. I think it worked well there. But because I wasn't at Lincoln, I'm not privy to those types of the current status of the technology.
Talk to us about your background. You know, how'd you end up here doing this?
Yeah, that's a hopefully an interesting story. So I had been doing another business, sort of a serial entrepreneur, had been doing a renewable energy business. And we wrapped that up, developing really big wind and solar projects around the country. Sold those projects and then was looking for the next thing to do, and then just moved to Boston. So spent a bunch of time, you know, doing a deep dive into AV and really spending time around the universities in the city. Had learned about what Lincoln Lab and Byron in particular had been doing here. And it felt to me, not just within the university community, but sort of in my general research, about the most exciting, most orthogonal, differentiated approach to increasing AV performance that I read about. So got in touch you know, with Byron, and there had been sufficient inbound interest to the lab that, you know, I think there was a clear signal from the market that this is something that that had legs. And as a result, you know, we decided to start the business around it to commercialize it.
You mentioned Byron a few times now. Did you essentially just cold call him and say, hey, I want to kind of work with you on the business side of that? How did that relationship form?
Cold email, yeah. that was the, joking aside, I got in touch with him. I said, hey, I think you're working, what you've been building here is an incredibly compelling technology. Obviously he knew that. and so we spoke over several months, kind of got the business plan down, licensed all of the IP exclusively from MIT that had been generated, which is very broad IP. We had a common vision for the business, complementary skill sets. So it felt like a good, a good jumping off point. And indeed it has been. We've been fortunate to hire a good team and are off to the races.
In a very general sense, I'm thinking about this. MIT has really made a big imprint on the automated vehicle industry in lots of different fashions. Waymo CEO John Krafcik is a graduate, as is RJ Scaringe from Rivian. Carl Yagneva spun Newtonomy out of MIT. What's the automotive ecosystem, for lack of a better term, like in Boston in general, and then out of MIT in particular?
Yeah, so it's coming out of Boston, it's pretty strong. You've got Carl and Newtonomy, who are doing great things now with Aptiv. You've got a bunch of startups that have come out of MIT and Harvard, and so there's a pretty robust startup ecosystem there. And then you've got a good talent pool between Bose and Veoneer being up in Lowell. It's an interesting mix. In terms of MIT in general, AVs are one of the hardest and most exciting technical problems of our generation. And what better place to find folks to work on it than MIT? So, I think the sector has been fortunate because it's really benefited from, for lack of a better term, the gravity of the technical challenge. And for folks that are smart and ambitious and are engineers, that's what they like to work on.
What is WaveSense's funding status right now?
Yep. So we raised a $3 million seed round last summer, so summer of 2018. We'll raise a Series A later this year or beginning of next and sort of go off to the races from there. So we're really focused on that. We've been so busy on the commercial side that we feel like we've hit the goals that we need to hit to raise the A round. And what we're raising it against is delivering a production award with an OEM.
When might we hear something about that?
That's a 2020 phenomenon, I would say. 2020 phenomenon.
Excellent.
Great. So we've talked about a lot of different applications throughout this conversation. So which would you say are the most valuable for you right now? And are you mapping certain areas or roadways at the moment? What seems to be the biggest priority?
So the biggest priority for us is the assisted driving and the L2 business. We feel, and this is a conversation we have with customers and investors all the time, we feel we can build a monster business on the back of L2 and ADAS alone. And we're seeing that just in terms of like where the market is really responding in the sharpest way to this technology. So that's where a lot of our focus has been. What that means is that we're spending a lot of time here in Detroit. We've mapped a bunch of the Detroit area. Of course, we've mapped a bunch of the Boston area. And then we've mapped a bunch of different application-specific areas. So highways, parking lots, parking garages, that sort of thing.
When we talk about potential markets, not just ADAS versus AV, but are you seeing trucking companies or ride hailing companies or traditional OEMs making cars for ordinary consumers, or are any of those standing out as use cases for this?
Yeah, so each of those is a use case we see a lot of traction on. We're spending, I would say, the most of our time on L2 passenger cars. And then next, probably AV and trucking. Similarly, with trucking, you have much tighter margin for error, and so this is pretty appealing. You've got a highway scenario where there aren't a lot of roadside features, so that's why trucking tends to come to us. On the AV side, you're looking at driving utilization as one of the most important things to making the economics of a robo-taxi work. Forget about the cost of the technology. You really need to be able to be carrying a fare all the time or most of the time. And so radically expanding the scenarios in which you can do that enables the AV companies to sort of improve their business model. And then similarly with AV, because this is something that is looking at uncorrelated features from the surface, you know, to put it one way, it improves their performance even on clear days. And as they're in this arms race to deploy first in the significant, you know, metro markets, this is one thing, not the only thing they need to solve, but one thing that gets them there sooner.
And gets them, I imagine, redundancy too.
Exactly, yeah.
Tarek, I'll throw the final word to you. Any last thoughts on WaveSense and where you're heading in 2020?
Yeah, no, we're really excited with the partner set that we have right now. You know, we've been fortunate to work with some of the top OEMs, top tier ones, and some other new parties in the space. And so we're nose down, heads down, nose to the grindstone, heads down on executing on those partnerships right now. And you know, I'm hoping we'll have some big news to announce in 2020.
Excellent. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Thank you, guys.
All right. Once again, that was Tarek Bolat from WaveSense. Thanks so much to Tarek for joining us today. And apparently we'll hear more about ground penetrating radar sometime in 2020.
Looking forward to that next year. But for now, that's our episode. So thanks so much for joining us, and we'll see you next week.